why do you do it? I mean, like, really think about the mechanics of this choice.
Right. It's a huge commitment.
It is. Why do people willingly leave the comforts of their ordinary lives? You know, surrender their autonomy over their schedules, walk away from their relationships, and just go sit in silence to face the raw feed of their own minds.
Oh, it completely defies the logic of modern existence. I mean, our entire societal infrastructure is designed to provide us with constant, seamless avenues to avoid facing our own minds.
Yeah, exactly. We engineer our lives to eliminate the exact kind of friction that a retreat deliberately manufactures. It's like modern life is this glitchy smartphone.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, just with way too many apps running in the background, draining the battery. And going on a retreat is basically the ultimate factory reset.
Yeah, it forces you to close all those tabs.
Right. Which is exactly why we've gathered a very specific stack of source material today. We're doing a deep dive into a collection of contemporary practitioner journals, personal essays, and interview transcripts from modern Buddhists who are actually navigating this path.
Real lived experiences, not just theory.
Exactly. Our mission in this deep dive is to deconstruct the actual lived reality of a retreat. We want to look past this cultural assumption that a retreat is, you know, some sort of spiritual vacation or an escape hatch from the real world.
Yeah, that's such a common misconception.
It really is. Instead, we want to analyze it as a transformative container, like a methodical process of returning to the body, the breath, and the deeper purpose of the practice itself.
Well, the distinction between a vacation and a container is just critical here. A vacation allows you to check out, right? But the sources we're looking at today describe a process that forces you to check in.
And with a level of intensity that sounds, frankly, exhausting.
Oh, it's often agonizing. Because one of the core beliefs here is that knowledge in these traditions isn't just theoretical, it's deeply physiological. It's most valuable when it's applied directly to your nervous system.
So it's not about hiding.
Not at all. These periods of deep isolation actually equip people to handle the crushing reality of the world. The whole design isn't built to keep you on the meditation cushion forever. It's built to prepare you to get off of it.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the paradox here is really fascinating. You isolate yourself from society in order to become better at participating in it.
Yeah, that's exactly the friction we're talking about.
So looking at the journals from Aaron, he's a practitioner who has logged some serious intensive time in Zen monasteries. He repeatedly frames these retreats as the deepest sources of transformation in his Dharma life.
Right. He doesn't see them as just a break.
No. And what stood out to me is his insistence that the shifts he experiences aren't temporary states. It's not that that fleeting spa glow that just evaporates the second you merge onto the highway on Monday morning.
Right. Yeah, the post-vacation crash.
Exactly. He's describing a permanent structural alteration to his baseline. He calls these monasteries training centers.
Which is such a deliberate choice of words.
It is. But if it's a training center, what exactly, you know, what is the sport they're practicing for?
Well, they're training for the reality of human suffering.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, think about the cognitive load of just a standard Tuesday. You're constantly processing social cues, managing dopamine loops from your devices.
Oh, it's the endless notifications.
Right. You're defending your ego in workplace hierarchies, navigating thousands of micro decisions. Your mind is perpetually managing external data.
Yeah.
So when you enter the silence of a retreat, you drop that external data to near zero. And suddenly, the machinery of your mind has nothing to chew on except itself.
It's like walking into an anechoic chamber. The ambient noise of the world drops away so completely that the loudest sound is just the blood pumping through your own veins.
That's exactly it. And a clearer mind allows you to perceive situations accurately. Aaron is using that extreme quiet to observe the actual mechanics of his own suffering.
So he's building the capacity to sit with intense physical and psychological discomfort without automatically reaching for his phone or a snack or any coping mechanism.
Exactly. He is deliberately inducing stress in a controlled environment to study his response to it. When you remove the distractions, your habitual patterns of panic and avoidance become glaringly obvious. You can map out how your mind constructs suffering out of neutral sensations.
And once you map it, you can navigate it better in the real world. You find the energy to take actual action.
Precisely. You gain the ability to short-circuit those reactions in the noise of everyday life.
But every training center needs a coach, right?
Right.
You don't just go to a retreat for the silence. Reading through these transcripts, you realize people go to be near teachers. You don't just study the texts. You need to see the texts walking around in a human body.
Because Buddhism deals with such abstract concepts, a teacher provides a living example. That transmission process relies so heavily on our biology.
What do you mean by that?
Well, humans regulate their nervous systems by mirroring the people around them. So when a student is sitting there in a state of high anxiety and they're in the physical presence of a teacher whose nervous system is profoundly settled,
they absorb that calmness.
Yeah, that proximity alone does more to communicate the reality of embodied practice than 100 lectures on non-attachment ever could.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And Alex G's interview perfectly illustrates this dynamic. He's a lay practitioner, balancing a really demanding career in business development with his serious daily practice.
Right. He's very much in the world.
Very much. And he notes that he uses retreats specifically to go deeper into practice and reconnect with his teacher, Lama, to close that gap between intellectual understanding and direct experience.
And he shares that incredible story about Lama.
Oh my goodness, the airport incident, yes.
It's just wild.
So for the listener, Alex describes a friend picking Lama up at the airport. And the friend is frantic, rushing, throwing luggage into the vehicle. And in the chaos, this friend accidentally slams a heavy car door directly onto Lama's head.
Just physically crushing his skull with the door.
Right. And the immediate biological reflex for almost anyone in that scenario is just an explosion of defensive energy. Most of us would yell or curse in pain. Your cortisol spikes, and the ego instantly constructs a narrative of victimhood like, look what you did to me. You hurt me. I'm angry.
What's fascinating here is the complete absence of that secondary narrative.
Completely absent. Lama experiences the intense physical impact, but his reaction was genuine wonder. He literally says, wow, that's so amazing. Everything went black for a second.
And it's unbelievable.
I know. He treats the trauma like a fascinating weather event that just happened to pass through his physical form.
Well, if we break down the mechanics of that moment, it perfectly illustrates living with spaciousness, humor, and total freedom from ordinary reactivity. The sensation of the door hitting his head traveled up the spinal cord and registered in his brain. But Lama had cultivated so much spaciousness in his mind that the sensory input of pain was decoupled entirely from the narrative of suffering.
He didn't take the pain personally.
Right. It didn't belong to him. It was simply an intense sensation that arose and dissolved. And when Alex watches that happen under sudden pressure, he's seeing what embodied practice actually looks like.
But Alex's story assumes you have the luxury of traveling to a teacher.
Right? Yeah.
It assumes the physical boundaries of a retreat center.
Which isn't the case for everyone.
Exactly. Cynthia's essays in our stack introduce a much more difficult reality. What happens when the container isn't a peaceful mountain sanctuary you drove to, but a set of agonizing circumstances forced upon you?
Yeah, this shifts the definition of retreat from a physical place to a state of mind, a way of relating to conditions.
Right. So Cynthia is deeply embedded in the complexities of modern life. She wrote extensively about practicing through the COVID-19 pandemic, and she quotes her teacher, Jokchen Pumlop Rinpoche, who made this profound statement during the height of the global lockdown.
I remember this quote.
He said, "Isn't this wonderful? The pandemic is a retreat. We don't have to go anywhere. We're already at home to practice and study."
He is reframing unwanted solitude, disruption, and uncertainty into an opportunity for deep practice.
Okay, but wait. The pandemic was terrifying and isolating for so many people. I mean, millions of people lost their livelihoods and loved ones. How do we look at this without romanticizing forced isolation? It edges dangerously close to toxic positivity.
Yeah, I totally get that pushback. And the friction you're feeling is exactly where the teaching operates. It's not about pretending bad things are good.
So he's not saying the virus itself is wonderful.
Not at all. Bypassing would be saying, everything happens for a reason. Just meditate and smile. What he is actually doing is encouraging critical thinking about how any disruption to our normal routine can act as a mirror for our own minds. He's saying you cannot change the boundary of the container you have been placed in, but you can accept it and change how you utilize the pressure inside it.
You stop fighting the reality of the walls. If you're locked in your house, terrified, the practice demands you turn around and examine that fear, rather than just waiting to go back to distracting yourself.
Exactly. The pandemic forced an unavoidable confrontation with the self. The forced pause acted as a mirror, reflecting all the internal chaos that our routines usually help us ignore.
But speaking of mirrors, that raises a really uncomfortable reality about retreats. If the container just traps you with your own mind, what happens when that mind is agitated or grieving?
Yeah, it's not all peaceful levitation.
Not at all. We have this cultural image of retreat as endless hours of peaceful bliss. But Ani Lodro, a Tibetan Buddhist nun, her reflections completely shatter that romantic image of what a retreat actually feels like on the inside.
She provides such a necessary reality check. Monastic life is often difficult, humbling, and incredibly uncomfortable.
Her warning is stark.
Mm-hmm.
She says, there's nowhere to run from yourself here. Whatever is unresolved within you will surface.
Because when you strip away the career, the social validation, the entertainment, the mind panics, you're locking yourself in a room with your own shadows.
Yeah, the suppressed grief bubbles up.
Mm-hmm.
Hidden agitation takes over. She reveals that retreat is often just agonizing ego withdrawal.
And the practice is to sit directly in the center of that withdrawal and refuse to move. By allowing the agitation to arise and pass, you slowly dissolve the ego.
And here's where it gets really interesting. You go to a monastery to meditate, right? To find enlightenment on a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
But Aniladro had this profound insight about what happens after the ego starts dissolving.
The shift into service.
Yes. She says, I came here thinking I would spend my life in meditation. Instead, I found that true practice is in the daily, ordinary acts of service. She found enlightenment in doing chores and serving others.
Well, the mechanism driving that shift makes perfect sense. Unwanted emotions surfacing is actually the mechanism that dissolves the ego. And when the obsession with your own internal weather burns out, what naturally rushes in to fill the vacuum is a drive towards selfless acts of service.
You chop the wood and wash the dishes so someone else has a safe container for their practice.
Exactly. It's the ultimate expression of the teachings.
Which brings us back to the lay practitioner like you, the listener. If retreat is this hard, uncomfortable work, why do modern people with jobs and kids keep going back?
Because the contrast between that environment and modern daily life is just so stark.
Yeah, the Vajrayana practitioner journals we reviewed dive into this tension. They talk about retreat serving as a place to wash off the stickiness of daily life.
I love that term, stickiness.
It's so visceral. It's that accumulated heavy residue of being a parent, holding down a job, paying bills, carrying endless responsibilities. It's like we need a deep psychological shower to scrub off the invisible grime of modern responsibilities that we don't even realize we are carrying.
And retreat allows practitioners to clear away those distractions. It reconnects them with their true, pure nature.
It drops the performance.
Exactly. It allows the teachings to become embodied rather than just intellectual. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the value of this washing is immense. We live in a modern culture that constantly encourages distraction, demands endless productivity, and basically runs on the avoidance of suffering.
To intentionally step into an environment where distraction is banned, that is an act of radical rebellion.
It absolutely is.
So pulling all these threads together from our sources, Aaron's training center, Alex Chi's living example of Lama, Cynthia's pandemic container, Aniladro's acts of service, and washing off that Vajrayana stickiness. The core message here is that retreat does not remove people from life.
No, it acts as a transformative container that prepares them to return to it.
Right. You return to your ordinary life more fully, with less grasping, more patience, more compassion, and more courage. So what does this all mean for you listening to this right now? You probably aren't abandoning your week to go sit in a 30-day silent meditation.
No, most of us can't do that. But I want to leave everyone with a final thought to mull over. If the true power of a retreat is simply the intentional boundary it creates around our attention, how might you build micro-retreats into the transitions of your everyday life?
Oh, I like that. Micro-retreats.
Yeah. What if you treated your 5-minute commute or even just the act of washing your dishes with the exact same reverence as entering a monastery? What if that brief silence was your container?
That is a profound way to look at a Tuesday afternoon.